Imagine this. You know, you've just spent like 6 years and tens of thousands of dollars mastering this highly delicate, incredibly taxing art of holding space for human trauma.
Oh, yeah. It is such a grueling process, honestly.
Right. And so you finally open the doors to your brand new private practice on a Monday morning. The paint is fresh, the armchair is super comfortable, and you are just ready to heal.
And then reality hits.
Exactly. Because then you suddenly realize you have absolutely no idea how to file a commercial tax return or write an SEO optimized web page or even legally invoice a client who just ghosted you.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I mean, it is a profound structural flaw in the way we educate
It
therapists.
really is. It's like, welcome to the terrifying reality of solo
Yeah,
therapy, right?
right. Because graduate programs are, you know, they're intensely focused on producing exceptional clinicians, which makes sense.
Of course, you want them to be good at the actual job.
Exactly. You learn all these advanced modalities, you write endless case formulations, and you spend hundreds of hours in practicum. But they almost never teach you how to be a business owner.
Never.
You're sent out into the world with this highly specialized clinical toolkit, but literally zero operational scaffolding.
In that operational void, well, that's exactly who we are speaking to today in this deep dive.
Yes, absolutely.
We are looking right at you, the beginner therapist who is looking to take that massive leap into solo private practice right here in British Columbia.
It's a big leap.
A huge leap. So we've taken a stack of sources, right? We've got interviews, case studies, insights from veteran Canadian and North American practice owners.
Some really great material in there, yeah.
Yeah. And our mission today is to extract a clear, practical roadmap specifically for you. We're going to cover the foundational business mechanics, the traps that quietly drain a beginner's bank account, and the actual actionable steps to get off the ground without completely burning out.
Which is so crucial because the burnout rate is real.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before you even look at commercial real estate or website designs, you really have to understand the specific regulatory playing field in British Columbia.
You do. The BC landscape is highly specific, and misunderstanding it is probably the first major trap.
Right.
Like, if we look at the experiences of clinics operating locally, like Pacific Pine Wellness from our sources, they illustrate a very specific reality about professional titles here.
Oh, the title issue. Yeah, this is wild.
It really is. In British Columbia, the term counselor is actually not a protected title.
Wait, really? Not at all.
Not at all. Structurally, this means anyone, literally regardless of their education or background, can legally print a business card, call themselves a counselor, and charge people for services.
Wow. I mean, that obviously creates a chaotic market for the consumer, but it also creates this distinct marketing challenge for a new graduate, right?
Completely.
Because if anyone can use the title, how does a highly trained professional, you know, actually signal their legitimacy to a client who's actively searching for help?
Well, you have to rely on the titles that are legally protected,
Yeah.
right? And recognized by insurance companies, specifically clinical counselor and psychotherapist.
Ah, okay. So those are the magic words.
Exactly. Clients, and honestly, more importantly, their extended health benefit providers, they are looking for those specific designations. And the primary way you signal that legitimacy in BC is by joining the provincial regulatory body.
Right, the BC Association of Clinical Counselors, the BCACC.
That's the one.
Now, the sources mentioned that joining the BCACC is technically voluntary from a legal standpoint, right? Like you could operate without them.
Technically, yes, you could.
But practically speaking, I mean, if you aren't registered with a recognized body, your clients cannot claim your sessions on their workplace insurance. So you're effectively cutting yourself off from a massive percentage of the client pool.
Exactly. The whole mechanism of private practice relies so heavily on insurance reimbursements. But beyond just the financial aspect, aligning with the BCACC mandates a strict adherence to their ethical standards.
Which is a good thing.
It is a great thing because when you're a solo startup, there's often this temptation to cut corners to save money. But you absolutely cannot cut corners on ethical oversight.
Right, you can't just wing it.
No. And the most critical piece of this oversight for a beginner is securing and paying for clinical supervision post-practicum.
Okay, let's define the mechanics of that because it sounds like just another, you know, line item on a budget. How does clinical supervision actually function for someone who is no longer a student?
So think of clinical supervision as a mandatory financial and clinical audit for your professional blind spots.
Oh, I like that phrasing.
Yeah, because when you leave an agency or a university, you lose the safety net of peer review, right? When you close the door, it's just you and a client with highly complex needs.
Which is a lot of pressure.
It's a ton of pressure.
Yeah.
So supervision involves paying a senior specialized therapist to regularly review your caseload with you. It's an external party ensuring you aren't unconsciously making decisions that'll stall your client's progress or, you know, trigger your own burnout or put your license at risk.
So it's really an investment in your own safety, too.
Absolutely. It is a non-negotiable operating expense.
You know, reading through the accounts of practice owners in our sources, there's this recurring theme of ignorance is bliss.
Oh, yeah. You see that everywhere.
Right. They admit that if they had fully grasped the sheer volume of regulatory, ethical, and administrative stress waiting for them, they might never have actually taken the leap.
Yeah, it's a very common sentiment.
Which makes me wonder about the timing of this transition. I mean, going from therapist to business owner is like learning to drive a manual transmission while already on the highway.
That is a perfect analogy.
Right. So since grad programs don't teach business, shouldn't new therapists wait until they take business courses before opening their doors? Like, just pause and get an MBA first.
What's fascinating here is that the sources strongly advise against that kind of delay.
Really? Why?
Because waiting until you possess perfect knowledge of business administration is just a one-way ticket to paralysis.
Oh, you just never start.
Exactly. The reality of entrepreneurship is that you cannot learn the mechanics of the market in a classroom. You learn them by interacting with the market.
Okay. That makes sense.
The veteran owners in the sources emphasize relying on the established wisdom of those who have already built practices. You do not need the skill set required to manage a $1 million group practice on day one.
Right. You just need to survive day one.
Yes. You only need the specific knowledge required to legally, ethically, and safely process your very first client. You build the rest of the infrastructure as the revenue dictates.
I love that. And that structural progression leads directly into the actual setup phase, right? Because the moment a therapist decides to open, the immediate panic is always the startup costs.
Always.
So let's walk through the exact physical and digital infrastructure required to open the doors without going completely bankrupt in the first 30 days.
Okay, so the minimum viable product for a solo therapy practice requires 3 structural pillars.
Okay, what are they?
First, a municipal business license, which has its own nuances depending on your location. Second, deciding on the physical versus digital delivery model of your practice. And third, integrating a comprehensive electronic medical record system, or EMR.
Okay, let's pause on the business license for a second, because it sounds like simple paperwork, but the sources indicate this actually dictates your physical setup.
It does, yeah.
Like if you decide to run a hybrid model and see some virtual clients from a home office, you have to ensure your specific residential zoning actually allows for a home-based business, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Municipalities have really strict zoning bylaws regarding client traffic, parking, and, you know, commercial activity in residential zones.
So you can't just start seeing people in your living room without checking.
Right. You have to clear that municipal hurdle before you can even register the business address. But once that is established, the digital infrastructure becomes the priority. And the sources heavily highlight a software called Jane App for the EMR requirement.
Yeah, I want to look closely at the utility of Jane App because it kept coming up. Why is this specific software so incredibly dominant in the Canadian therapy space?
Well, it really comes down to cognitive load and federal compliance. In Canada, therapists must adhere to strict privacy laws regarding health data, specifically PIPEDA.
Right, PIPEDA. That's a big deal.
It's massive. And Jane App is natively compliant with Canadian privacy standards, meaning their servers and data storage methods automatically meet your legal requirements.
Oh, so you don't even have to think about it.
Exactly. But mechanically, it eliminates software fragmentation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when a solo beginner is running the business, you do not want to be duct taping different systems together, you
right.
know, like using a calendar app for scheduling, a separate Zoom account for telehealth, a third program for your clinical notes, and then a fourth platform like Stripe or Square for processing credit cards.
Right. Because every time you switch software, you lose time. And every single platform takes its own monthly subscription fee.
Precisely. It adds up so fast. Jane App centralizes the entire workflow.
Okay, walk me through how that actually looks for a client.
So a client books directly on your Jane portal. The software automatically emails them the intake forms. It hosts the secure video call if the session is virtual. It holds your encrypted clinical notes. And then it automatically processes the client's credit card at the end of the hour.
Wow. So it's doing the job of like a full-time receptionist.
Basically, yeah. It automates all that administrative friction, which allows the beginner to reserve their mental energy for actual clinical work.
Okay, so JNAP solves the digital overhead. But that still leaves the biggest physical threat to a beginner's bank account, which is commercial rent.
Oh, yeah. Rent is the killer.
I mean, looking at commercial real estate listings anywhere in the lower mainland of BC is enough to induce a panic attack.
It really is.
But the sources point to this structural alternative that bypasses traditional commercial real estate entirely. Instead of signing a terrifying multi-year commercial lease for an empty room, beginners are partnering with existing holistic wellness clinics.
Yes, this is brilliant.
Like massage therapy or physiotherapy offices, such as Bosnar Health, which was mentioned in our sources.
Mm-hmm.
You integrate your practice into their space and agree to a percentage-based rent split rather than a flat monthly fee.
It is a highly effective entry strategy.
It's like training wheels for commercial real estate.
Yeah. Let's look at the mechanics of why this works for both parties, right? Because a physiotherapy clinic often has underutilized treatment rooms.
Right, they have empty space.
And they want to monetize that empty space without taking on the liability of hiring an actual employee.
Right.
So they bring you in as an independent contractor. You provide a complimentary wellness service to their existing foot traffic.
Win-win.
Exactly. And in exchange, instead of paying them, say, $2,000 a month, you just give them a percentage of your possession fee.
Wait. I see the appeal of a percentage split for safety early on, but mathematically, doesn't that become a massive financial penalty once your practice is actually full?
Wow.
Like, let's say the split is 70-30 where the clinic keeps 30%.
Yeah.
If your session rate is $150, you are giving them $45 every single hour.
Right.
If you're seeing 20 clients a week, you're paying them $3,600 a month. That is significantly higher than just signing a standard commercial lease for a small room.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, mathematically, yes, your projection is correct.
Okay, so it is a penalty eventually.
A percentage split becomes highly expensive at peak capacity. But you have to analyze the primary goal of your first 12 months in business.
Which is what?
Your goal in year one is not maximizing your profit margin. Your goal is risk mitigation and survival.
Ah, right. Because you don't actually have 20 clients a week in month one. You might literally just have two.
Exactly. If you only see two clients in a week, a flat $2,000 lease will put you in debt instantly.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
But with a 70-30 split, if you see two clients, you only pay $90 in rent.
Yeah, wow.
And if you take a two-week vacation or if you get sick, your rent drops to zero. A percentage split ensures that your overhead scales directly with your revenue.
That is so smart.
It completely eliminates the financial terror of a slow month. Now, yes, when your practice is consistently bursting at the seams, you renegotiate to a flat fee or you move to your own space. But in the volatile launch phase, that 30% is just the premium you pay for absolute peace of mind.
That makes the math entirely justifiable. You're basically buying a runway.
Precisely.
Okay, so the infrastructure is built. You have a legally zoned address, JNAP is processing your forms, and you have zero risk space in a wellness clinic.
You're ready to go.
Right. But now comes the operational pivot that keeps literally every new entrepreneur awake at night, which is client acquisition. How do you convince strangers to pay for your time?
Yeah, this is where the panic usually sets in.
And the sources tackle the marketing anxieties of beginners directly. And I love this. They aggressively dismantle the idea that you need to be a social media influencer to get clients.
Thank goodness, right. Because it is a pervasive modern fallacy that online brand visibility somehow equals business revenue.
Yes.
We see therapists attempting to manage these incredibly complex Instagram content strategies or film TikTok trends because they genuinely believe it's a mandatory prerequisite for a modern business.
Exhausting just watching it.
It is.
Yeah.
But the sources explicitly confirm that plenty of highly lucrative, fully booked private practices have absolutely zero social media footprint.
Which is such a massive relief for the listener. Because managing a content calendar on top of a clinical caseload is a recipe for instant burnout.
Oh, guaranteed.
But if social media isn't the primary driver, then what are the actual mechanisms that fill a therapy schedule?
So the fundamental mechanism of a therapy referral is trust.
Right.
A viral video might generate views, but therapy requires deep vulnerability and a real financial commitment.
Yeah, people need to trust you before they hand over their credit card.
Exactly. And trust is primarily built through direct professional relationships and hyper-specific positioning.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, for a beginner, the most effective marketing strategy is local professional networking. You identify the gatekeepers of your ideal clients.
Who are the gatekeepers?
Family doctors, nurse practitioners, school counselors, and even other therapists who are currently full. You take them for coffee, you explain exactly who you help, and you become their mental shortcut for referrals.
And the sources emphasize that becoming that mental shortcut relies entirely on picking a niche, right? The power of niching down.
Yes, heavily.
Because if you try to be on every platform, or if your website says you treat anxiety, depression, couples, children, eating disorders, and sports performance.
Which is way too much.
Right. You're just signaling that you are a generalist.
Yeah.
And the sources say the actionable advice is to pick just one or two marketing strategies that feel authentic.
Right.
So you don't stand out to a referring doctor who is dealing with a very specific patient crisis if you're a generalist.
Precisely. Think about it. A family doctor has roughly 7 to 10 minutes with a patient.
That's nothing.
It's nothing. If they identify a patient struggling with complex PTSD, they need to make a referral instantly. If you have clearly positioned yourself as the definitive expert in trauma and EMDR in your specific neighborhood, your name is the one that comes to mind.
Right.
A generalist just does not stick in the memory of a busy medical professional.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though.
Yeah.
I understand the theory behind specialization.
Yeah.
But put yourself in the shoes of a beginner therapist who has student loans and personal rent to pay.
Okay.
If they niche down on day one and explicitly state they only treat specific trauma cases, aren't they actively turning away a paying client who calls asking for general anxiety counseling?
I know. It feels incredibly counterintuitive.
Right. Niche marketing sounds like financial self-sabotage for someone who desperately needs initial cash flow.
It really does feel that way, but the data from practice owners proves the exact opposite. A specialized practice builds a wait list much faster than a generalist practice.
Really? How?
Let's look at the psychology of the consumer. When a client is in pain, they are not looking for a jack of all trades. They're looking for a specialist who deeply understands their specific agony.
That makes sense.
Niching allows your website copy to speak directly to one person's exact experience, which creates this immediate sense of trust. Furthermore, the sources note a really fascinating byproduct of strong niching, which is that you will still attract outlier clients.
Wait, what do you mean by outlier clients?
So a client might read your website, see that you specialize in trauma, and think, well, I don't have severe trauma, I just have generalized anxiety, but I really like the way she explains the nervous system, and her office is like 3 blocks from my house. Right. They will book with you anyway. Niching is fundamentally a marketing strategy to cut through the noise. It is not a legal limit on your capacity for empathy.
That distinction between the marketing strategy and the capacity for empathy is brilliant. And it's actually the central conflict of running a private practice, isn't it?
It really is.
We're moving from the acquisition phase into the daily management phase now. And this requires a fundamental identity shift. You know, you have to take off the compassionate therapist hat and put on the ruthless CEO hat.
Yeah.
And those two identities are often at war with each other.
It is the most profound psychological friction a new owner will face. Because graduate school trains you in radical empathy, unconditional positive regard, and accommodating the needs of the vulnerable.
Right. You're literally trained to be accommodating.
Exactly. But business management requires rigid boundaries, enforcement of policies, and prioritizing the survival of the corporate entity.
Which feels so harsh.
It does. Hey. And the most common arena where these two identities clash is the enforcement of cancellation policies.
Oh, man. The scenario is universal. A client fails to show up for a Tuesday morning session. They email you saying they had a terrible week, their car broke down, and they couldn't make it. The empathetic therapist instinct is immediate.
Oh, of course.
You think they are in distress? I cannot possibly charge them $150 for a session they didn't receive. That just feels exploitative.
But the sources are structurally very firm on this. You must enforce the fee.
You have to.
If you do not charge for that time, you have permanently lost that revenue. But your rent, your software fees, and your licensing dues, they remain exactly the same.
Right. The landlord doesn't care if your client's car broke down.
Exactly. The way you navigate this ethical friction is by establishing the boundary as a structural rule during the very first intake session, before any emotional conflict arises.
You script it out in advance. You explicitly tell them, My policy requires 48 hours notice for cancellations. I enforce this strictly not to punish you, but because it ensures my clinic remains financially viable so I can continue offering care to you and all my other clients.
Exactly. You frame the boundary as a mechanism of mutual respect and sustainability.
That's so powerful.
Right. Because when the no-show eventually happens, you don't have to make an emotional decision in the moment. You simply execute the business policy that the client already agreed to in writing.
Yes.
If you continuously waive fees out of guilt, you will financially exploit yourself until you burn out, close your doors, and effectively abandon your entire caseload.
And protecting the business means protecting your time across the board. The sources emphasize that you cannot simply squeeze CEO tasks like billing, marketing, or networking into the 10-minute gaps between clients.
No, that never works.
You must block out sacred boss time on your calendar. This is dedicated non-clinical time strictly for accounting, returning emails, updating your website, analyzing your metrics. Mm. If you do not aggressively defend that time, the administrative burden bleeds into your evenings and weekends.
And when the administrative burden bleeds into your personal time, you become highly susceptible to what the sources call the catastrophizing trap.
Oh, the catastrophizing trap. I know this one well.
We all do. When a beginner therapist is exhausted, their brain shifts from managing the present to projecting disasters into the future.
Like they look at a slow week in July and immediately assume they'll be bankrupt by December.
Exactly. They start panicking about next year's tax brackets before they have even filed their first return.
The anxiety just spirals because they're carrying the weight of both the clinical outcomes and the corporate survival simultaneously.
Yes. And the antidote to that spiraling, according to veteran owners, is rigorous present focus.
Okay, what does that look like?
You have to pull your operational attention back to the current day. You ask yourself, what are the three specific actionable business tasks for this Tuesday?
Just three things.
Just three. Execute those tasks consistently, close the laptop, and trust that the six-month horizon is built on the foundation of these daily actions.
So what does this all mean for the listener on a daily basis? I mean, how does a deeply empathetic therapist reconcile wanting to offer barrier-free, equitable care with the harsh reality of needing to pay their own bills?
This raises an important question, and it's really the core ethical dilemma of the profession.
It is. We want to help people, but we also operate in a capitalist system.
Right. And the sources provide a structural solution to this through the calculated use of a sliding scale.
Okay, lay the math out for us.
So the mistake beginners make is broadly undercharging everyone to make therapy affordable, which basically just guarantees the therapist's own poverty.
Right.
The sustainable approach requires actual math. First, you calculate your absolute baseline operating costs, your rent, software, taxes, supervision, and your personal living expenses.
Okay.
Based on that exact number, you establish a standard full fee for your sessions.
So you set the baseline that sustains the clinic first.
Yes. Once the clinic is mathematically secure, you decide on a strict percentage of your caseload, let's say 15%, that you will dedicate to sliding scale or pro bono spots.
Oh, I see.
If you see 20 clients a week, three of those spots are heavily discounted for community members facing financial barriers. The other 17 full fee clients effectively subsidize those three spots.
That's brilliant.
You are actively serving the community, but you are doing it through a structured mechanism that ensures your practice remains completely solvent.
It's about designing a business ecosystem that actually supports the life you want to live, rather than inadvertently creating a low-paying job that you constantly need a vacation from.
Exactly.
So let's look at the complete blueprint we've extracted for you today. If you are preparing to launch a solo private practice in British Columbia, here is your structural roadmap. First, understand and navigate the BC regulations accurately. Register with the BCACC so clients can utilize their insurance and immediately secure clinical supervision to audit your clinical blind spots.
Crucial first step.
Second, build a low-risk infrastructure. Use a comprehensive PIPEDA compliance system like Jane App to eliminate software fragmentation. Mm-hmm. And actively seek out a percentage-based rent split in an established wellness clinic to completely eliminate the financial terror of a slow first month.
Get those training wheels on.
Exactly. Third, ignore the pressure to become an online influencer. Focus on local professional networking and pick a hyper-specific niche so you become the immediate mental shortcut for referrals.
Niching is everything.
And finally, recognize that your empathy is for your clients, but your boundaries are for your business. enforce your cancellation policies, calculate your sliding scale mathematically rather than emotionally, and fiercely protect your administrative boss time.
The transition from clinician to owner is, honestly, it's an incredibly demanding journey. It requires unlearning the perfectionism trained into you by academia and stepping into the highly uncomfortable reality of trial and error.
It really does.
But the ultimate reward, you know, the freedom to control your clinical schedule, to choose the specific clients you are best equipped to help, and to design an ecosystem that aligns with your own life, it makes navigating those complex operational mechanics entirely worth the effort.
We know that right now, as you look at that fresh master's degree, your entire focus is simply on surviving year one. But we want to leave you with a final lingering question to mull over as you build this foundation.
Yeah.
You're focused on surviving year one right now. But what happens when you succeed? What happens when your solo practice gets so incredibly full that you have to choose between turning away vulnerable people in need or expanding into a group practice and risking becoming the Walmart of therapy? Design your foundation today for the kind of success you actually want to manage tomorrow.